This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Joseph Janes. He's an associate professor and chair of the MLIS program at the University of Washington Information School. He's written a column for the American Libraries magazine for more than a decade, and he's the author of the new book, Library 2020. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You mentioned in the introduction to your book, Library 2020, that you chose the year 2020 for your book's essays because it's sort of far enough in the future for things to change significantly, but not so far in the future that it's meaningless extrapolation. But let's start with a little meaningless extrapolation. What does the library of the year 2200 look like to you?
Wow. Yeah, just transpose the digits and you get a whole new world. You know, that's one of those questions that you either have to get cosmic about or throw up your hand. So I'll probably do both. I won't be here to see it. So whatever I say, I won't ever be proven wrong or right. Somebody asked me, one of my colleagues on the faculty here asked me a few years ago, what would the library look like in 100 years? And that was sort of just when, you know, the questions about the future began to get really serious. I think it was the beginning of the financial crisis and, you know, libraries were starting to worry about being closed and consolidated and such. And I was thrown by the question about 100 years because it's so far out. And, you know, are we all going to be in hover cars? Are we all going to have blaster rays? You know, where are we going to be in 100 years? Shiny jumpsuits. And what the only thing I could cling to was going back 100 years and what had persisted. And actually quite a lot has in many ways. And you know, thinking about the things that have persisted, I mean, unfortunately, there are some processes and procedures that have persisted, and that's not always to the good. But right. But there is a kind of continuity to our ideas about libraries and, you know, beyond the little details about serials check-in and, you know, so on. There is continuity, and the continuities are the really, really central things. And actually those wound up forming the very broad structure of the book. There will be stuff. There's always going to be stuff. You know, the stuff may be different, the stuff may be in different forms, the stuff may be, you know, created differently, the genres may be different, but there will be stuff, probably far less materially than we're used to, but there will be stuff. People are going to crave a sense of space in whatever kind of world we live in. People are going to crave some sort of place and sense of place and sense of space, sense of place within whatever space we're living in. There will be communities of whatever configuration and complexion and makeup that libraries emerge from and are intended to serve. There will be people who work within these institutions to make them work and to serve those communities. There will be senses of values and ethics and things that distinguish libraries from other kinds of institutions. And those institutions are going to need leadership and vision. And those I think, are the kinds of things that have persisted in some cases for thousands of years, and in some cases for decades and centuries. And so I think those are good kind of guideposts to stick in the ground and say, all right, let's talk about space. Let's talk about people. Let's talk about communities. Let's talk about stuff. Because otherwise it becomes shiny jumpsuits and hover cars, and that's not productive because then you're just making stuff up.
Right, and I think the best speculative fiction, best science fiction, is usually says more about the present than it does about the far-flung future. Even if there are jumpsuits and whatever, there's more of a, you're talking about the present, you're not talking about the future.
Right. I mean, I got asked over the summer to write a little piece for our alumni association. They were doing a screening of the Star Trek movie, and they asked faculty to write little one-page essays for people to read while they're online. And they made their way to me for some reason, which is great because I'm a lifelong Star Trek fan way back to the original series. And, you know, that's a very everybody thinks about the transporter and the medical systems and the phasers and so on. But, I mean, that's an information-driven system. The tricorder is an information device. The communicator looked like the old flip phone. Voice-activated computer systems. There's a lot of episodes of that show that get solved by searching the library computer at some narratively critical moment.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that reinforces that information stuff continues to be important and continues to be critical in solving problems, in understanding things better, in, you know, all kinds of ways. So, yeah, I think in many cases, these discussions about where we go from here have a very strong overtone of what are we doing today and what should we be doing literally tomorrow.
Right.
It's far out.
Right, and I got a lot of that from your book. That seems to be what a lot of the authors were coming from, was sort of looking at what the sort of the problems and the issues that we're dealing with now, and how we're going to deal with them, or how they might spin out, and how they might be dealt with in the future.
Yeah, people. That's one of the real virtues of this, is that people took lots of different approaches, and some people took the 2020 thing very seriously and are writing in the sort of future past mode. And others are talking about what do we need to do today to get to 2020 or to avoid what 2020 might be like. And since I gave people no instructions whatsoever other than to be interesting and to start with the single phrase, you know, the library in 2020 will be, I was really quite gratified that people took so many different approaches and undertook them so well. And yeah, there's as much in here about the recent past and present, if you're reading carefully, as there is about the near and even further term future. And I think that's among the reasons I found this so interesting personally, and other people seem to be so taken with many of the ideas in here as well.
So what made you want to put the book together in the first place? What was sort of the idea that got you going?
Well, to be honest, my publisher called me one day and said, "Hey, you haven't done a book for me in a while. Want a book?" I have to give credit where credit is due. Charles Harmon, who I've worked with for years in a variety of settings, came to me with the idea. First asked me if I wanted to write a book about the future, and I'd just as soon kill myself. But then said, "Well, do you want to edit a book about the future?" And I said, "That's a great idea, because then it isn't me." Then I can't be wrong if it didn't come out that way. So I'll let all my friends be proven wrong, and won't that be better? But I was, you know, there's been so much talk about the future for the last, gosh, certainly for the last several years, as things have changed so dramatically, because not only because of technology, which we've gotten kind of used to, but also the economic and social climate as well. But even going back, you know, when I was involved in the Internet Public Library Project all those years ago, back in the middle 90s, people were really asking questions about what is the library going to look like going forward. So the idea was intriguing, but I wanted to do something that wasn't just, you know, yet another book about the future that no one will pay any attention to and will be quickly forgotten. So the idea of short pieces and the idea of pieces that, I thought that little trick of starting with the common sentence, it became a sort of fill in the blank game, and a kind of a Rorschach test. And I was really pleased to see people take that on in such diverse and interesting ways, and just to see, you know, what a bunch of really smart, talented, interesting people would say if you ask them, you know, don't dwell on this, but think about it, and you know, where are we going, or where might we be going, or where ought we not be going? And that was great fun to watch them start to come in when I asked people to write essays for me.
So, how did you choose who you approached?
Well, I started out being strategic, and then that just completely fell away. I really did want a great range and diversity of ideas. I didn't want it to be just the usual suspects, you know, the same 10 people you hear over and over again. I didn't want it to be just one perspective. I didn't want it to be just one kind of library. I didn't want it to be just one anything. So, I approached largely people I knew, because it's just easier to ask favors of people you know, and tried to get as broad a brush as I could of background, experience, institutional setting, you know, people I've known for a long time. There's a handful of former students in there, which, you know, is a real blessing for having been an educator as long as I have. I've got a lot of current and former students who've done really interesting things. And I also wanted to get people who were new in the profession. People who had not been around since the year one, people who did not train with dialogue or BRS, or, you know, people who don't fondly remember the National Union Catalog pre-1956 imprints like I do, and as well as people who have been around and been in the wars and been at this for 20, 30 more years. And so as I started to pull together lists, I thought, wow, all right, that's an interesting group. And most of the people I approached said yes. I had some people who just weren't able to because of scheduling you know, other sorts of things. So the large majority of people I approached were able to help out. And I think as a result, I got this quite intriguing constellation of people from all over the profession and all over North America, as it turned out.
Before you wrote the essay that you close out the book with your own essay, did you read all the other essays first and try to decide?
Yes.
I want to write something that they didn't talk about.
Well, yes and no. I mean, sure. I mean, it's my book, so I get to go last and I get the advantage of reading everybody else's. And nobody in the book, I didn't do this really intentionally, but nobody knew who the others were. Mainly because I was doing this over a period of time, and so I didn't, you know, it was kind of no good way to say, hey, guess who joined the club? But yes, I had read all the others. And partially, I mean, if I had written mine and, you know, written exactly what Dan Chudnoff had written or Cliff Lynch or Lorraine Roy, I mean, what would be the fun in that? But also, I mean, a good deal of what I would have said if I were one of these people is what I had said anyway. And so I didn't feel like I was completely just, you know, finding the open spaces or filling the gaps or whatever. It was, you know, my own 25 cents at the end is largely what I would have said anyway, maybe not quite so long, but largely what I would have said anyway. But yes, I did have the benefit. But I didn't want to write the, you know, pick the highlights and connect the dots kind of thing, because then you leave somebody out and then you're, you know, there's no way to do that and be authentic about it. So I just took my own shot at it.
Did you find some, you've got the book broken down into some sections, but did you find some common themes that were running through all of the essays?
Yes and no. The other side of having the kind of diversity and breadth here is that you just get lots of different things, and it's very difficult to characterize all of them. And I've had a couple people ask me, you know, so what does your book say? And, well, my book says about 25 different things. So buy it and read it for yourself and figure it out. There is a large vein of optimism running through it, but it's not a universal optimism. And there are at least a handful of pieces that are very dark. One in particular is, well, one or two in particular are kind of dystopian, although one of them kind of pulls out at the end and has a rallying cry at the end of it. I'd say there's a pretty strong thread of inventiveness, of people thinking about ways in which things might be very different, or things that we might do to make things very different. In you know, people wrote these in 2012, so it was an 8-year time frame. Now it's a 7-year time frame. There's a thread of, you know, making, I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, that the library still has juice in it. And what people wrote about was, even when they wrote about things that would be very different, they still had the kind of library DNA in them. And I tried to pick up on that in my essay, that whatever the library is in the short and, for that matter, long run, it still has to be a library. It still has to feel like a library to us and to the people we serve and the communities we serve and the people who pay the bills. But, you know, within those very broad things, you get, you know, essays that are very nuts and bolts and very, you know, really down in the trenches, and others that are way up at the kind of philosophical level of what a library is meant to be. And that's great. Without trying to engineer that, without trying to suggest to people what to write, because I completely didn't, all I told people was be interesting and start with that sentence. And, you know, for whatever reason, they wound up occupying a lot of space between each other. That's what I got. So,
well, and even the darker essays, I think, were more sort of seem to be darker in a, if libraries don't do this, then this is what's going to happen. It wasn't a libraries are doomed. It was a, if libraries don't do this, then they're doomed.
Right. There's a lot of cautionary tales, and I mean, most of them are presented in that way. I think there are a couple that you can read and think, well, you know, there's just a lot of things that are going to go on that are out of our control, and we have to be able to respond or react to that. And that's, I mean, that's always been the case. We are not in the driver's seat in many aspects of what's going to happen to libraries, you know, in terms of the way the future economy works, and in terms of technology, in terms of what, you know, what the future of information dispersal is going to be. You know, we have market power in the publishing world, but that's clearly being tested at the moment. We have a lot of mind space in our communities and our constituencies, but so do a lot of others, and that's getting pretty crowded, or continues to get pretty crowded. So there's a lot of these levers that are out of our control, but we don't also, I think there's a thread in here of we can't be completely reactive. We have to be active, we have to be thoughtful, we have to be creative and innovative, but in a way that feels right to our communities and to ourselves, and also kind of, you know, perpetuates the way people think about libraries and feel about them. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a tremendous reservoir of positive feeling about libraries everywhere, and you see it all over the place. I mean, all of the threats and potential closings and layoffs and stuff, and some very bad things have happened. But a lot of communities have risen up, and we've seen that recently in Miami, you know, most recently in Miami. But it's happened in lots of other places as well, where communities have just risen up and saying, no, you are not going to do that to my library, because it's too valuable, it's too important, it's too much a part of my life. And so out of this, you know, very difficult period where a great deal of adversity has been visited upon us all, there are these stories of tremendous reservoirs of support, which I think is, which is a real testament to how hard we have worked over the decades to serve our communities really well.
Yeah, I believe it was in your essay that you mentioned that libraries can coast to a certain degree on our what we've done previously,
yeah,
but that we still need to have a vision for the future of where we're going.
Right. I mean, the do nothing solution, the, you know, everything's fine, stick your fingers in the ear, la 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 solution, which is just to go on. in the short run, sure. I mean, tomorrow, if everything is the same tomorrow as it is today, people will still come, kids will still have stories told to them, summer reading programs will go on, books will get on shelves, you know, metadata will be created. That's all fine. But you can't imagine that that's still going to work in 7 years. I mean, when you think about all the things that have happened in the previous 7 years, and how the complexion of the world is changing, about how information is shared, about increasingly mobile and app-driven information work, about how, you know, how communities are changing, about how money is changing hands, and how things are distributed. I mean, you just can't imagine that a steady state solution is at all workable. And to be honest, I don't think, you know, 10 years or so ago, there were people who genuinely believed that if you just sort of waited it out, all of this change would go away and we'd somehow go back to the good old days, whatever those were, which were old but weren't necessarily all that good. And I think a lot of that has gone away. There is still a stratum of the profession that is deeply unhappy about what has happened over the last 15 years, and still kind of mad about it, and as a result, either, you know, actively or passively working against innovation and trying to do things. I think that stratum is diminishing, but it's still there. And it's a real challenge to us. It's among the greater challenges we have. You know, to me, that's counterbalanced by when I look at the leadership of lots of our major libraries and smaller libraries as well, for that matter, when I look at the kind of people running ARL libraries and urban library council places and, you know, people I talk to in leadership positions, there's a lot of energy there. There's a lot of enthusiasm for the future. There's a lot of really interesting stuff going on. And when I look at my own students and our recent graduates, people who have these great ideas and tremendous energy, and they know so many things, and they're so facile with technology, and they're so engaged in trying to help people and all of this, you know, that is what gives me optimism and hope, is when I see the leadership and when I see the new blood coming into the profession. And if all the rest of us could be as welcoming as we could be of that kind of leadership and of that kind of energy entering the profession, we're in really good shape. And there's lots of places where that works, and that those are real role models for all of us.
Well, at the end of your essay, spoiler alert, you say that librarianship is the most important profession. Can you elaborate on that?
I say this all the time. I say this to my students. I say this to people who come to our information sessions. I say this in classes. I say this all the time. With all due respect to our colleagues in the other professions, and particularly to those who are nearest to us in the, you know, in the archival world and the museum world and so on, we make everybody else better. We as librarians, we as libraries, as institutions, are one of those professions that the human record is entrusted into our care. We have the record of everything that has gone before. And we make that usable. We collect it, we evaluate it, we organize it, we manage it, we search it, we help people to use it so that they can create new things. With the human record in our care, we are in a position to make healthcare better. We make education better. We make agriculture better. We make law better. We make science better. We make everybody else better, because all those functions are better knowing what has gone before. And as a result, to my mind, what we do is the most critical thing that humanity does, is to keep the record and keep it alive and help it to be used and consulted so that we can do better next time. And that, to me, is the most satisfying, nourishing thing you can do. That's part of the reason that, you know, Library Journal does these surveys and they ask librarians, would you, if you had it to do all over again, would you? And they routinely get like 80, 85, 90% of librarians say yes, they would choose this career again. Well, it's not for the money or the fame or the glamour, I can tell you that. We all know better than that. It's because it's you know, it's just so important, and it's just so fascinating, and it's just so necessary. And it makes such a huge impact in the lives of individuals and our communities. You just can't, it's hard to kind of overstate that. And people don't necessarily think of us that way. You know, we have done a great job of making our work invisible because it's in service of so much other work. And that's a virtue, but it also runs the risk of then people ignoring you or overlooking you or taking you for granted. And so, I mean, that's why I say all the time to anybody who will listen that librarianship is the most important profession, because without we make everybody else better. And I don't think people don't appreciate or think about that until it's brought to their attention. And plus it may, you know, it's a rallying cry. And we could use those, because it helps people to acknowledge the value of their own work and their own profession. And I think it's hard to overdo that.
Well, you've been mining that, record of humanity there with your podcast, which is Documents That Changed History.
Yes.
What made you want to do this, number one, the project? I mean, it seems sort of a very librarian-y kind of project, but what in particular made you want to do it as a podcast as opposed to, you know, proposing it as a new column for American Library or Library Journal or something like that?
I've always been kind of fascinated by the radio. I think if I'd been born 70 or 80 years ago, I would desperately want to be on the radio, much as I am kind of on the radio right now. And I hate being photographed, so radio works really well for me. And as almost anybody who's ever taken a class from me or knows me at all knows, that I love nothing better than the sound of my own voice. So podcasting is perfect for me. And I just like the format. The way I've been doing the pieces that I've been doing, they're about anywhere from 7 to 10 minutes long. And so they're these little dollops of history about important documents and the impacts they've had, and also about documents themselves. It's another of these, you know, people don't think about the power of documentary forms until you sort of reveal them to them. And, you know, what these things are and why they happened and how they've made an impact and how they also have woven their way into everyday life without us really thinking about them very hard. And I approach those as a librarian, but I also approach them as a scholar and researcher and also as an information scientist thinking about, and there's a whole vein of research in information science back to the middle of the last century about documentation. That actually is the origins of information science in a lot of ways, the study of documents and how, in those days it was technical reports and journal articles, but how documents got the way they are and what social functions they inhabit and how we use them. And I also try to make them fun and interesting, and because that could be pretty deadly. The response so far has been quite gratifying. Once people discover it, they love it. So, and I love doing it. As I'm, basically doing the research for those things is like being a reference librarian, which is what I was born to do. So I research something, I dig it out for a couple of weeks, I read all this stuff, I write up a little script, I record it, and then I can move on to the next. It's paradise. I cannot tell you how insanely fun it is to do these. And I'm up to about, I just did number 23. And I love doing them. Love, love, love doing them.
Well, and the fun thing, I think, is that, and you've said that this is sort of your mission, even, is that you're not going to do a Constitution one or a Magna Carta. You're doing documents that are really important and people know what they are, but it's maybe a different angle than.
I did do a constitutional amendment. I wasn't going to do the Bill of Rights because, what right. is there to say about the Bill of Rights that hasn't already been said? I finally broke down. The last one I finished was the Rosetta Stone, and I finally broke down to the Rosetta Stone, partially because I was just in London at the British Museum and went to a little talk about it, and it kind of inspired me. But also because I found something to say that hasn't necessarily been said about the Rosetta Stone, about which a great deal has been said. Let me tell you, I just read it all. But the journey of the Rosetta Stone as a document, everybody thinks of it as the big rock in the British Museum, and it's the way we cracked the code of Egyptian hieroglyphics and therefore rediscovered their civilization. Yes, 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 all true. And the Egyptians won it back. Yes. So there's a little bit of, cultural repatriation going on in there. But mm-hmm. But this thing was quarried out of the side of a hill about 2,200 years ago, sailed down the Nile, carved, and then it became a thing. Now it's a decree. Now it's propped up outside a temple, and people, hey, this king is really important, even though he's a little bit shaky and only a teenager. And then it gets taken down and made into building material, still carved. So it's still a document, but nobody sees it for about 1,000 years. Then it gets dug up. Then it gets, put in the British Museum, and then it becomes, the gateway to Egyptian civilization. So the journey of that thing as a document, and for at least 1,000 years, it sits underground. Is it still a document if it's buried under the foundations of a fort that it's used as building material for? There's an interesting question. I think that whole journey is just quite stunning, and that was something that nobody had. I couldn't find anybody talked about it because they're not interested in it that way. They're interested in it as an Egyptology thing, as a museum thing, as an artifact, as a this or that. But nobody had yet, at least not that I found, had talked about the thing as an information object exclusively. So, and the others I've chosen have been, the first IQ test and Robert's Rules of Order and the AIDS quilt and the 18 and a half minute gap and, you know, Gutenberg's indulgences and things like that, that, you know, people were kind of vaguely aware of, but they don't know the story of necessarily. And they certainly don't, they haven't thought about it in the sense of, you know, what are these things as documents, as information objects, as historical objects, that sort of thing. So that's why this has been just so fascinating for me, is to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think the one about Pope Benedict's resignation letter was my favorite one.
just
the interesting to go back and then hear all the history about the papal history and all this kind of stuff was really interesting.
Well, and that was the first one I did sort of as the result of something that was going on in the real world. You know, I've been doing this for a few months when the Pope decides to up and resign. Well, you know, how does the Pope do that? It was the first one in several hundred years. And so, you know, so then you go back and you do all the papal resignations, including the crazy one who lived in a box. And one of the cardinals put a tube into the box to convince him to retire because it was easier to be rid of him than not. And there's all these great, you know, only the papacy has that kind of longevity. Right. You get those kinds of stories. But then, you know, then you get into resignation letters. And Nixon's and Edward VIII's and, you know, how do you and the point of a resignation letter is to say that at a specific time and date, I am no longer this person anymore. I am no longer the president. I am no longer the king. I am no longer the CEO. I am no longer the dean. I am no longer the pope. And it so it really gets into certainty and finality. That the point of a resignation is to eliminate ambiguity about who's in charge. And the document is something you can point to and say, okay, you said that on this date and in this hour, you are now no longer this person. And that piece of paper effectively has the power to dislodge you from that position. Now, granted, it's a piece of paper you signed, whether willingly or not, but you know, the instrument of abdication said that at that point, Edward VIII was no longer the king and somebody else was. And Nixon was no longer president and Gerald Ford was. And Benedict was no longer pope. And then for a while, nobody was because they hadn't elected a successor yet. And I didn't really realize that was the story until I got into it. I thought, oh, my God, the pope's resigning. Everybody's talking about the resignation. I should do something about that. So that was the only one I did sort of on demand as an event was going on. And as a result, it was a much more compressed process. But you know, lots of people were talking about papal resignations. And I thought, well, okay, I can say something about that. And it wound up being about ambiguity and finality, which I didn't quite anticipate.
So does that happen a lot when you start to research something, it kind of goes in a different direction than you thought it was going to?
Very much so. You know, I did the rules of association football, the rules of soccer. Because I'm a sports fan, and I just thought that'd be kind of cool. And that wound up getting into creativity, that, you know, rules, all sport, somebody said, and I quoted this in the podcast, sport without rules is just play. So, you know, if you're just out in the field kicking a soccer ball around or playing a pickup game of softball or whatever, you know, you can make a rock into second base and you can make the car into home plate and whatever. Nobody really cares. But any sport has rules, and the rules are often lines and structures and prohibitions. And, you know, would we have the Hail Mary pass if there wasn't a clock in football? You know, you only do the Hail Mary at the very end of a half or the game because otherwise you don't have to. So you wouldn't have the Hail Mary if there wasn't a clock. You wouldn't have a spinny serve if you didn't have lines, the service lines in tennis. You know, you wouldn't have the three-point shot if you didn't have the arc in basketball. So all rules produce creativity, because without constraint, creativity often goes flying off into the ether. So I didn't really anticipate that was going to wind up being about creativity until I really dug into the nature of constraint. And they all, many of them have sort of taken that that kind of road. I did the letters of transit from Casablanca, because I'm also a movie nut. And that wound up being about travel documents and just the history of travel documents and how pieces of paper help us move from one place to another. which, you know, you don't, there's my passport and you don't really think about it, but there's a whole sort of history of not only, you know, travel documentation, but also personal identity. So many of these have wound up being, you know, you tell the story of the object and you tell the story of the impact it had, but then it also, you know, it reveals something a little bit more about the nature of how we think about ourselves, how we represent that in some sort of documentary form.
And one of your episodes was done by one of your students.
I've actually had a couple. Yeah, I had a student, Andy Brink, who's now working at Vulcan, a little over a year ago. He and I worked on the first two together. He did Jon Snow's cholera map, which was fascinating and is still the most popular episode in the series. And I did the Gregorian calendar. And so we kind of worked together to figure out what the thing would be like and how to do it and how to record them and all the, you know, all the mechanics of it. And then I had a student last spring, Eli Ganderud, who did the first X-ray. And he's now happily employed down at the University of Puget Sound, which is great. So my students are two for two in terms of work with me. Make a podcast episode. That's the lesson that they've learned. For them, it was an opportunity to do the research and think about how you would present this and, you know, it was a great experience. And then I had a couple other students, Carly Williams and Kat Cuff, who built a website that I'm about to launch to house all a Drupal site. So they learned all about Drupal and such to house the podcasts, which one of these days I'll get it populated and then I can launch it. It started as a project with a student and I'm glad that I was able to work with more last year and hope to do so again. But for the moment, it's just me plodding along, you know, making my way through history one document at a time.
Yeah. My wife is an epidemiologist, so she liked the, that episode, the Jon Snow.
And the cholera map, you know, we were both sort of groping our way through this and read this truly gruesome book about the cholera epidemic, which is just, oh my God, that's a terrible way to die. You know, we got down to the document part of it, and I said, you know, that's the cholera map is big data. It's mid 19th century big data, because what Jon Snow was facing, what public health there was in middle 19th century London, which was precious little and completely wrong, because everybody believed disease was caused by miasma, by bad air, yep. You know, instead of bacteria in the water, among other things. And so he had, you know, the weekly death statistics that were being published. He had interviews and firsthand accounts from people who were living there. He had observation of what was going on. And this is pulling lots of data sources together, each of which had a piece of the puzzle, but none of which had the answer. But it was the integration and then the production of the map as a way of kind of consolidating large amounts of data that really crystallized all of it and helped people to understand, first of all, why everybody was dying and which pump it was that was infected. But then also, oh, you know, the disease is caused by water, not by air. And that still took decades, even though he had, you know, the answer. It took decades for the miasma theory to lose favor. And even today, you know, stuff that smells, you want to avoid it because that's going to make you sick or whatever. Which may or may not be true, but that's not what's doing it.
Right, right.
Yeah. So they're just really, really fun. And I've got a list of another 30 or 40 that I haven't done yet. And I'm always finding, you know, oh, yeah, I could do that one. Oh, yeah, that'd be kind of cool. There's always another one. So I'm still having a ball doing those.
Yeah, I assumed you had a really long list that you're in no danger of ending the podcast.
Oh, gosh, no. You know, and if anything, I keep cycling through like, oh, I should really do that. But then I get distracted by something fun and like, oh, I'm going to do this instead. And yeah. I among other things, I'm easily distracted by shiny objects. And starting as we record this, it's September. This coming quarter here on campus at the UW, I'm teaching a freshman seminar haven't taught freshmen in so long, I don't even know what they look like. I'm teaching a freshman seminar about with this as a theme. So I've got 15 freshmen, and we're an hour a week, and we're going to take a document a week, and it will be just fascinating to see how 18-year-olds think about the first IQ test and the Gutenberg indulgence and Einstein's letter to Roosevelt about the atomic bomb. And I was going to do the 18-and-a-half-minute gap, the Watergate 18-and-a-half-minute gap, and I thought, they don't even remember Watergate.
Right.
And that was just too – because I lived through Watergate. That would be just too depressing is to try to – I mean, I can talk about the Rosetta Stone with them. That's not going to bother me. But the fact that they have no idea who Nixon was, that would freak me out. So I decided against the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. But and the Obama birth certificate. That will be very interesting. The discussion around birth certificates, and I'm less interested in the Obama birth certificates than in birth certificates in general. But I mean, that's a way to introduce it. So,
yeah, that was a great episode too.
Yeah. And again, that one, you know, I was motivated by doing because of the whole birther thing, and you know, whatever. But then, what a birth certificate is, and what it's for, and how it's structured, and all the rules. You know, it reads like cataloging codes and all these little, because, you know, this is a big deal. And it's the first document anybody ever gets, follows you for your whole life, used in vital statistics. So I found this, you know, these government documents about how to fill in birth certificates and how to, you know, what the rules are and how to decide, you know, what the place of birth was and what if you don't know who the father is and what if they don't have a name yet and all of this stuff, which is, you know, very familiar to us because, you know, what if you don't know who the author is? What if you don't know when the thing was published? What if it's, you know, what if it's fugitive material? What do you do with it? So it reads very familiarly. My favorite little tidbit is if a child is born on a moving conveyance, so like in an airplane or on a boat or whatever, the official place of birth is wherever the thing lands.
Huh.
So if a child is born in an airplane and then it lands in, you know, Las Vegas, the child is officially born in Las Vegas. Even though they might have been born, you know, 30,000 feet over Kansas, even though they don't let pregnant women fly anymore. But if it's born on a boat, then it's where it docks. If it's born on a train, it's the next stop. Because you got to have a – I mean, how do you know? You're too busy giving birth to the child. You don't know where you are. So, and there has to be a place of birth. So that's as good a rule as any, which makes as much sense as cataloging rules do. So
in the middle of a birth, you don't say, whip out a GPS quick.
Yeah, get your GPS device. You know, where are we? Oh, I think we're in Nebraska. All right, then you're born in Nebraska. Right, which doesn't make any sense, but you see both sides of that. So right. That was the, you know, that was one of those that was the first one that kind of took me in a direction I wasn't expecting. Okay, birth certificates are, again, who thinks about their birth certificate? Nobody. I mean, I've looked at mine a bunch because I did the podcast and I've used it as a prop. But, you know, the last time I actually needed it, I think, was to get a passport. And that would have been like 30 years ago. And nobody looks at my birth certificate. And nobody, like, it's possible nobody will ever look at my birth certificate again. And yet, without it, it's the beginning of my entire identity. And without it, all the pieces crumble. But again, even if I lost my birth certificate, I'd go get another copy. It's quite extraordinary when you think about it, how pervasive these things are and yet how completely invisible they can be.
Except when you're running for president.
Except when you're running for president. And now we've been through this whole thing again with what's his name?
Ted Cruz.
Yeah, who I guess was born in Alberta, but he didn't mean it.
Right.
So, really American. Oh, my God. You know, well, sorry, dude. That's the rule. You know, if you don't like it. And we would have been down this road with John McCain because he was born in the Canal Zone, which was a territory, but it wasn't really a state. So was it the United States or not? And right. And right. And, you know, 30% of people think that Obama was born in Kenya or some ungodly place. And, you know, well, and you're never going to change that.
Yeah, I just imagine the people in the Honolulu Secretary of State's office or whatever is just ripping their hair out all the time.
Well, I mean, they put up a page on their website, like, do not bother us with this anymore. Here it is. And so the birthers have all these, you know, conspiracy theories about the document and why it wasn't released and so on. And then there's the people who have picked apart the PDF that Hawaii's Department of State has put up, that the PDF is wrong, that the PDF has too many layers and it doesn't have the right, you know, encoding and it's been tampered with. And I'm like, oh, my God, you people are nuts. But there's no way you can convince people. Absolutely no way you can convince people. I did one of the major anti-Semitic tracks, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which, I mean, it's been disproven in so many different ways you can't possibly imagine, that it's a fake, that it's plagiarized, that it's, you know, and there are still people who, I mean, it's still being published, it's still being read, it's still being believed, and there's just no way to outprove a conspiracy. If people believe that the president was not born in Hawaii, or if that he's a Muslim, or if people believe that 9/11 was an inside job, or people believe that the Jews are trying to take over the world, or you can't prove your way out of that, because then that's part of it. Then that's the conspiracy. That's all, you know, that's all part of the deal. So,
right. The proof is the cover-ups.
Absolutely right. There are large online tracts devoted to demonstrating that the disproofs of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion are part of the larger conspiracy, by pointing out bits and pieces of the disproof of the proof of the origins and genealogy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That's all part of it. So when you read this stuff, I got lost half the time because I wasn't sure what I was reading. Was I reading the real protocols, which is a fake? Was I reading something that was disproving the fake? Was I reading something that was disproving the fake? And they all take the truth for granted. So they don't say, you know, nobody says, well, here's what so-and-somebody else says, because they're only interested in one side of the argument. It's like being in a funhouse. I mean, you just don't know which way is up. So I had a lot of trouble writing that one because, or at least keeping track of my own research, because it was so backwards and jumbled and upside down, and there was no way out of it. So I had every once in a while I had to stop doing the research because I didn't know where I was anymore. And then of course I had to work in cabaret, you know. Because why not? And the song from Cabaret, there's this, you know, sort of anthem in the middle of Cabaret that winds up being Stormtroopers. And it's a lovely song that sounds like a German folk song, but is actually written for the show. And then there's these, you know, white power groups who believe that it's a real Nazi song that's been played, and they think it's the only good song in Cabaret because the rest of it's a real downer because it's all about anti-Semitism and Nazism and the war and so on. And I found these, you know, discussion groups from white power supremacy people trying to find the German lyrics to the song. You know, when was the original song written? And there's white power bands that have recorded it as a sort of, you know, I mean, completely in violation of copyright law, but they don't care, as a kind of, you know, uplifting song for the white power crowd. And it was written by two Jews for a musical, and they won the Tony for it. And I found one of these discussion boards where somebody finally broke in and said, you know, this was written for Cabaret, and it was written by Kander and Ebb, and they're Jews. And it just killed the discussion, because the whole point of the discussion was what a great song it was, and how do I get the original lyrics, and who wrote it, and, you know, do you have recordings of it in German, and blah-de-blah-de-blah. And then, you know, it takes a while for people to come to the realization that the person saying that it was written for Cabaret is right, and they don't even try to contradict him. They just stops the discussion. It was extraordinary to see, you know, what the truth will do when people just can't hear it.
Right. How dare you bring facts into discussions?
Well, there wasn't even indignation. There was just, I mean, I could picture people sitting at home, you know, in their discussion boards, and they just don't know what to do with it. And so they just stop. There wasn't, I was expecting rants like, how could you say that? Blah, 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 blah. It just stopped. And then they moved on to other things. It was frightening, but also revealing that you can't prove your way out of a conspiracy. And that's a little sobering.
Well, to bring it back into more positive, on that note, your book is all about the future, and I think generally, as you said, it's a generally optimistic thread for the future. But as a library information school professor, how do you keep up the curriculum with the future so in flux? How do you keep up what you teach the students to know sort of what to teach them?
It's very hard. And I'm right in the middle of facing that as we speak, because we start classes in about a week and a half. And one of the classes I teach for our new master's students is about information resources and services. It's not really a reference class, but it you know, we talk about information resources and how they developed. And so that includes the book and the scholarly journal. And, you know, every year about this time, I go back and think, well, you know, what's happened to the book this year? Oh, my God. You know, what hasn't happened to the book this year? And what's happened to the scholarly journal? And, you know, so I've been through the whole Google Books settlement thing. I've been through the whole ebook thing now twice. You know, what's going to the ebook, first ebook attempt in the early, you know, 2000s, and then now again, and open source journals and open access this, and you know, oh, God. But I can't not talk about Gutenberg. So, you know, every year it's something's got to go. You know, what, and I haven't decided yet what it is this year, but. Or you just have to do it faster and yet still make it coherent. So I don't talk about the Google Book settlement anymore because I just don't have time for it. And it doesn't seem as relevant as, you know, the things that we're learning from places like Douglas County about pricing models and distribution models for ebooks and what publishers will and will not allow us to do anymore. So I spent several years picking apart the Google Books settlement and all the bits and pieces of it and who was right and who was wrong. And I just don't have time for that anymore. So the Google Books thing is gone.
Right.
And I feel like I ought to do the Apple thing. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get into that. Because, again, it's you can't just say, oh, and then Apple got sued and they lost and now they have to do this. But let's talk about this instead. You know, it's breadth versus depth. And you try to do both, but you know, it becomes increasingly challenging to do justice to everything. And you know, and then you read things in the press are like, oh, you know, what are they teaching people in library schools these days? Blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, we're trying our best. And,
right.
And it's not, you know, it's not for lack of wanting to cover everything, but, you know, as it is, we've got students for 2 years. We're one of the longer master's programs in the business at a full 2-year full-time program. And people still leave like, I'm not ready. You know, I still got 3 more classes I want to take and I still want to do this internship and I still want to work on this project. I'm like, sorry, you're done. You're cooked. Out you go. Learn it on the job. Have a nice life. You know, we got the next crop coming in. And, you know, and then you get raked over the coals because you're not teaching some picky shit thing that people want to whine about in library journal. Well, sorry, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people who are librarians who majored in Tuesday afternoon anyway, so, and I was kind of one of them. So, you know, I respect what our colleagues in the profession say because they, you know, they're facing the reality of the situation every day and, you know, their training budgets have been cut. That was the first thing to go. I totally get it. But, you know, we can't do justice to everything. There's just no way to do justice to everything. So, you know, for those of us in the education business to respect and acknowledge that there are things we simply cannot cover. And there's lots of different programs and some cover some things in more detail than others. And I tell people all the time, you know, we may not be the right program for you. If you're looking for something really specific that we don't do, don't come here because it's not doing you any good and it's not doing us any good. But here are the things we do really well. So if you're interested in this and if you're interested in this kind of a education and this kind of a program with this unbelievable faculty and this incredible staff and these fantastic students, then by all means, come and join us. But it is frustrating. And you know, I also spend a lot of time standing in front of classes feeling about 150 years old because I say things like, well, you know, back in the old days when we had gophers, holy crap, you know, I mean, I'm feeling ancient about things that they've never even heard of that was only 10 or 15 years ago. But I you know, I don't feel right about sending them out the door without knowing about the National Union Catalog pre-1956 imprints. I mean, I do teach that still in reference, not as a useful tool because it's hardly ever is, but
right.
but because it tells a story about what we as a profession have done. Is that was a monumental task that we took on and did really well. And it was a really great idea for about 20 years, and then it was gone. And there's a lot of stories embedded in that, and you need to – I think people are better off for knowing those stories. And we happen to have them on open shelves here so people can go look at them. And every once in a great while, it comes in handy. But you also need to know about, you know, Google Now, which just came out a few weeks ago, which is freaking people out.
Right.
And you know, except it's a great idea, except for the part of it that's incredibly intrusive and creepy. And somewhere in between the National Union Catalog pre-1956 imprints and Google Now is where we sit and where we go from here.
So what is it about libraries at their core that you think will keep them relevant until 2020 and beyond? And just why do you think libraries will endure into the future?
Well, there's something about them. What we've seen over the last few years of people really rising to the defense of their libraries in communities supporting their public libraries, in academic communities and school communities to support their libraries, that really bespeaks something about the role that these things play in our lives. That you know, again, it's easy to take them for granted. It's easy to stereotype us, this bun and the sensible shoes and the sexy librarian image and all of that, notwithstanding. There is a real... to use a horrible business phrase, there is a real value proposition to the thing. And when you get right down to it, the large majority of people recognize and acknowledge and appreciate and value that. And that's something we have built up for generations, that kind of support, that kind of service mentality, that kind of niche within the community that people really value and that we value as well as professionals. And it's one of those institutions that it's just really hard to think about doing without, even as different as we all know it has to be, and as familiar as we all know that it has to be. We're also constrained by, you can't change too much too fast because then you lose people. And then it becomes, you know, well, what now? Wait, that's not what a library is. What are we doing about this? So within that probably fairly narrow set of parameters, there's room for tremendous innovation. I think people want us to succeed. Nobody hates libraries. Well, a few people hate libraries and librarians, but not very many. We're one of those professions and one of those institutions that people generally have a real fondness for. They want us to succeed. They want us to be better. They want us to be there for their kids, for their parents, for themselves, for their communities, for their schools, for their institutions. They want us to be good. They want us to be available. And I think people generally recognize that they are better off with us than without us. When I meet librarians and when I talk to librarians and when I see our new students in a couple of weeks, there's still this drive, this almost need to serve, to help communities, to help people, to build the tools, to undertake the services, to lead the institutions, to be able to be even better and stronger and more effective for our communities. And so you put that all together and that, and you add a dash of innovation, you add a dash of imagination, you add a dash of risk-taking and productive failure, of which I'm a big fan. And to me, that's a recipe for success. And I think ultimately I am hopeful. And actually quite confident that the library world and libraries in general and librarians will thrive in a familiarly different or differently familiar kind of way and continue to grow and strengthen in the days and years to come.
All right. Well, Joe, thank you so much for putting all your thoughts together and your friends and colleagues' thoughts together in the book, and for sharing your thoughts about the future of libraries here with me today.
Well, thank you so much. This has been great fun.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com. Or you can follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas or on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.
Both barfing up a lung. I think that's the miracle of editing, right?
Yeah, we can do a special edition later of just those sounds.
Which I'm sure people would find far more interesting if I'm going to say this one.